Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back from vacation next week. The United States is calling for tougher sanctions on Iran. This comes after the Justice Department alleged Iran was involved in a plot in Washington targeting a Saudi diplomat and the embassies of Israel and Saudi Arabia. We'll talk about the latest details and what it means for U.S. relations with Iran. Joining me in the studio, Michael Greenberger of the University of Maryland, Barbara Slavin of the Atlantic Council, and Trita Parsi of Johns Hopkins University. Well, welcome to you all.
Thank you.
We appreciate you joining us on the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to take calls from our listeners later in this hour. You can reach us on our toll-free line, 1-800-433-8850. You can always send us an email at drshow@wamu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Well, Barbara, I've got to say, this is one of the most bizarre stories I've ever heard of in Washington. Give us an outline of what we know now the United States is alleging.
All right. Well, I was trying to think of the Farsi word for cockamamie, but maybe Trita knows. This began last spring when an Iranian-American who lives in Corpus Christi, Texas, was apparently back in Iran and having conversations with people, and the idea came that they should kidnap or perhaps kill the Saudi ambassador to the United States. And according to this charge sheet, which we have seen, it's not yet an indictment, it was decided that this gentleman would go and contact members of the Mexican drug cartel, with whom he appeared to be familiar, and see if they might arrange the hit. The plot proceeded. His cousin, again, allegedly has some connection with the Quds Force, which is an organization that I used to think of as an elite branch of the Iranian Secret Service. Another alleged Quds Force person was brought in. Money was agreed upon, $1.5 million to do these things, and $100,000 was allegedly wired to the United States or to a bank through the United States to pay off the killers. Now, there are a lot of strange things about this, and we can get into the details. I mean, beyond the odd MO for Iran, which had not previously done anything like this before, one thing that just stood out at me this morning as I read it again, everyone knows that you can't transfer more than $10,000 without it being immediately vetted and checked. Also, given banking sanctions on Iran, you can't transfer money out of Iran anywhere, not even 50 cents through an American bank without somebody knowing. So I have a lot of questions about this.
Well, Michael Greenberger, you worked in the Clinton Justice Department, and your purview included some areas of counterterrorism. So should we believe these allegations, or should there be some skepticism?
Well, I think the incident needs to be broken down into two parts, as the Obama administration is doing. That which they believe they can prove in a court and beyond a reasonable doubt, because this is a criminal matter, and that which they admit they don't have conclusive proof on, but given the modus operandi of Quds operations, they can make inferences that I think the international community is accepting. On the conclusive proof, whether it was wise or unwise, the transferring of the $100,000 was the key factor here. That showed this was not just an imaginary crazy thing, but that money was actually changing hands. Secondly, the Iranian U.S. citizen who is the principal who lived in Corpus Christi, Texas, and was a used car dealer, waived his Miranda rights, and he apparently talked a lot about this and admitted things. Now, it's somewhat strange because his public defender is saying he's going to plead not guilty. That strangeness becomes a little less strange when you know that the underwear bomber who just underwent trial in Detroit started a trial and on the second day pled guilty. So you could see that there'd be this dichotomy.
But the administration sent out Attorney General Eric Holder, the highest ranking law enforcement official they could have sent out to announce this. Would they have done this if there was any question in their mind about whether they were on pretty solid ground?
I think for purposes of the criminal proceeding, whether or not these individuals intended to commit a serious terrorist crime against the Saudi ambassador Leave aside the Saudi ambassador, blowing up a restaurant in the middle of D.C. in and of itself would be a shock to the system, and plans to blow up the Saudi and Israeli embassies. I think they feel they're on very, very solid ground there. They can go into court. My expectation is this guy will ultimately plead guilty. The second perpetrator is in Iran. They don't have access to him. Now, as to the diplomatic side, whether how high up this went in the Iranian government, there the Hillary, you say that Eric Holder made the announcement, but Hillary Clinton has and the vice president have been very active on the diplomatic side. And yes, you can believe this is a strange thing, but as some wise retired media person, Saudi Arabia said, if we had caught the 9/11 perpetrators a week before the accident and heard about them hijacking planes, sending them into the World Trade Center, trying to hit an important target in Washington, we would have said before that happened, wow, this is out of the question.
Actually, it made me think of another incident, the Iran-Contra affair. I remember when we were covering that, and we heard that President Reagan had sent a cake baked in the shape of a key to moderate Iranians because to put in place a scheme of selling arms to Iran, diverting the profits to Nicaragua. That sounded extraordinary, and yet it turned out to be true. So, Trita Parsi, what about the question of who was involved in the Iranian government and how high up this conspiracy might have gone?
Well, we frankly don't know yet, because beyond the statements from the administration and the allegations, there's really nothing that has been presented that comes close to being conclusive evidence. Now, granted, the administration believes it has it and are going to present it in court. And I think it's going to be tremendously important that they do this. And I actually would recommend that they do as much of it as publicly as possible soon, because the amount of question marks that are being raised about this throughout the world. In fact, I just spoke to a very prominent profile in Washington just before the show, and he had been in contact with a leader from one of the Arab states in the Persian Gulf. And that person is no friend of Iran whatsoever. In fact, probably would like to see a confrontation. But in spite of that, he had question marks about this. So it's critical to put some of those question marks to rest, particularly mindful of the fact that the administration is planning to take this. In fact, they're already starting the process of taking this to the Security Council. The United States of America cannot afford another Colin Powell moment at the Security Council. They need to have the strongest, most convincing evidence to go there again.
Now, you're referring, of course, to when Colin Powell went to the Security Council, laid out the case against Iraq on the issue of weapons of mass destruction, which turned out not to be the case. So do you think they just need to provide the evidence for what they're saying? Or do you think there is something kind of more fundamentally wrong with the allegations?
There's nothing normal about this story. The example about 9/11, I think, is an interesting one. But at the same time, let's not forget that there was an attempt at blowing up the World Trade Center a couple of years before. In the court, in the trial of that case, one of the experts witnessed and said the only way to bring down the two towers is to actually fly in an airplane into it. So I'm not so sure that this is as unrealistic compared to this. But when you take a look at what the involvement of the Iranian government in terrorism, which I think has solid evidence for, it doesn't follow this pattern in any way, shape, or form. And that doesn't mean that it's unlikely, but there's several different questions that need to be answered. What's the motive? What could they possibly think they could gain out of this? Why now? If there is the target is the Saudis, why do it on U.S. ground? Because if this allegation is true, then this is a tremendously dangerous and unwise escalation by the Iranian government.
So, Barbara, why would the Iranians want to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the United States?
You know, that's a really good question. With all due deference to Adel al-Jubeir, the Saudi ambassador, he's not a member of the royal family. He's someone who's personally close to King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. But I quote in a story I wrote for Interpress Service today, Bruce Rydell, who's an expert on both the Middle East and Iranian terrorism. He calls Adel a messenger boy, basically, for the Saudi government. He's not, you know, symbolically perhaps prominent, but why him? There would be, if you want to assassinate a Saudi, you would assassinate a member of the royal family, somebody really, really significant. A lot of questions about it. Again, just going back to the specifics of the complaint, it all seems to rest on the confession of this Mansour Arbabsiar and the conversations that he had with this informant for the Drug Enforcement Agency, which were taped. And there's one point where he says in a meeting in July that he wants the money sent in increments of $10,000 because of this rule about, you know, tracking money that's more than that. And yet the $100,000 was transferred in two lump sums of nearly $50,000 each in August. Was he trying to get himself caught? Was this some kind of case of entrapment? Was this something going on within the Iranian government where they wanted, you know, dissidents within the Quds force who wanted to humiliate the regime? I mean, there are just questions after questions after questions, and that's why I think Treat is absolutely right. The more the administration can tell about this, the better. Going back to your point about Saudi Arabia, Iran and Saudi Arabia have been engaged for a long time in a rivalry for influence in the region. We see this in Bahrain. We see this in Syria. We see this in Lebanon. They are on opposite sides in Iraq. They are on opposite sides pretty much everywhere in the region. But assassinating the Saudi ambassador to the United States, I'm not sure what that gains you in terms of the regional struggle.
What do you think, Marco?
Well, I first of all agree that we can't, as to this further question of how high up in the Iranian government this goes, we need more information. I'm a little more sympathetic to the Obama administration on this. Iran is under a lot of pressure right now. Yes, they've been dealing with the Saudis in Bahrain and in Syria, but they've been losing ground. The United States has, by supporting the Arab Spring, humiliated them. And I think they were prepared to reach out. They didn't want their fingerprints on it, but I think we are now finding out they hoped Al-Qaeda would be blamed for this. Discord would be sown.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about what this is likely to mean for U.S.-Iranian relations, and we'll also talk about the rather odd profile we're seeing of this alleged Iranian plotter. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio, Trita Parsi. He's president of the National Iranian American Council and a professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University. And Barbara Slavin. She's a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and author of Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies, Iran, the U.S., and the Twisted Path to Confrontation. And Michael Greenberger. He's director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland. So, Trita, if this plot, of course, did not come to fruition, thank goodness, what is the impact just of the fact that it was uncovered and it's going to be a court case and the administration is focusing on it? What impact is that likely to have on U.S. relations with Iran?
Well, again, if this alleged plot turns out to be true, then it's an extremely serious escalation from the side of the Iranians. The administration has already decided how they want to utilize this for their policy. And what it is being utilized for is to make a significant push at the Security Council and internationally outside of the Security Council to ratchet up sanctions even further. And I think there's a lot of questions that can be asked about the utility of that. We should not forget that this event, if true, actually came out during a period in which we had sanctions on Iran. Imagine if this happened during a time in which we had diplomacy with Iran. Then the first voices that would have been raised is to say, see, diplomacy doesn't work. Why would the Iranians do this in the midst of diplomacy? Well, now if this is true, it happened in the midst of a sanctions period. Yet our response is going to be to do more sanctions. There's one thing that Barbara said I thought was very interesting. In this regards that there was a $100,000 transfer, I think divided into two. Well, those transfers, whether through an American bank or a non-American bank, essentially are illegal right now, and they can't take place. If, however, this plot is true and the IRGC did transfer $50,000 into a U.S. account twice, well, then that shows us that at the end of the day, these financial sanctions are tremendously effective in hitting the wrong people in Iran. But it's not hitting the IRGC because they apparently managed to get the money through.
Well, Barbara, it seems like we've had sanctions on Iran for some time. We tighten them. What's your assessment of what kind of effect they have, and what are the additional sanctions that we could see?
Yeah, I mean, the United States has done pretty much everything it possibly can. There is talk about sanctioning the central bank of Iran, making it even more difficult for Iran to carry out financial transactions of any kind. But the pattern has been that both the United States and Europe have tightened all sorts of restrictions on investment in Iran, trade with Iran, and Iran has shifted to trade and investment from China, trade with India, trade with Turkey, Malaysia. So it has simply shifted its trading patterns. It's become more expensive for Iranians to do business. It's hurt the middle class. In a way, has actually helped the Revolutionary Guards because they're actively involved in smuggling and all sorts of illicit transactions. I mean, again, the other thing that was odd, they deal very much in currency transfers that go through things like hawalas, informal mechanisms of transferring cash. They don't use bank accounts that can be traced. What more can the administration do? Not much. It can use this, however, as a means of encouraging the Chinese, the Russians, the Turks, Indians, others to cut back on their trade with Iran, their investment in Iran. And this comes at a very delicate time for Iran. There's going to be a report this weekend from the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights for Iran that's going to talk about all the abuses that have occurred inside Iran since its 2009 elections. There's going to be another report from the International Atomic Energy Agency next month that may have evidence that Iran actually has been working on a warhead, a nuclear warhead, which, of course, it denies. So all of this put together, I mean, putting myself in the mind of the Obama administration, will allow it to sort of make a case for the most stringent implementation of the most stringent sanctions, to be able to say, particularly Obama in a presidential year, that he's not being soft on Iran and that they're sort of doing everything they possibly can to contain this country.
Well, Congressman Peter King, who chairs the House Homeland Security Committee, has called this plot an act of war. And Michael, I wonder, could that spark some kind of military response by the United States?
Well, on that front, the administration has been very careful to say that they haven't taken the option off the table, but they've been walking away from a military response. And in fact, they briefed the chairman of the Senate Intelligence and Senate Armed Services Committee, and both chairmen, when they came out, said this is a very serious allegation, needs to be looked at, but it does not merit an armed response. So they're walking a tightrope here. I think it wouldn't. There will not be much discussion, but there will. You know, the Obama administration has the look backward to the Colin Powell incident, where the Bush administration and Secretary Powell were tremendously embarrassed. Hillary Clinton is a very bright woman. I think they will. They will, by saying they're going to the United Nations, by briefing all embassies, by making a big point out of this. I think I agree that we need to know more, but I intuit that there is something here that is substantial. And the end here is to make the world believe more strongly in the sanctions that have been imposed, which have not received enthusiasm. And there are other sanctions, as was mentioned, the central bank, a commercial airline has been sanctioned. When you move from diplomacy into terrorism, the ability to grasp more sanctions becomes available.
Trita, you have written, was it in the Huffington Post, a piece where you warned that we could be on the precipice of a major war in the region if diplomacy isn't reengaged. What do you mean by that? What do you think could happen?
Well, as you see, this is a piece that Reza Marashi and I wrote. As you see, there is an effort now to really beef up the sanctions. And what we are in is a containment policy. Containment as a policy essentially is to be on the verge of war constantly. It is true the administration, I do not believe, has either expressed or has the intention of starting a military confrontation. But if we take a look at how containment worked during the Cold War, there's two reasons why it didn't end up in a complete disaster, why there was somewhat of a stable policy. On the one hand, there was, even at the worst times, a hotline between Moscow and Washington. There was diplomacy, there was de-escalatory mechanisms, there was an incidents at sea agreement, there was all of these different diplomatic efforts in order to make sure that if a misunderstanding were to occur, they could sort it out, it would not escalate into a conflict. Secondly, there was also ample awareness on both sides that if a military confrontation were to occur, it would likely be the end of mankind. If particularly, of course, it went nuclear, which was very likely. These two things created a natural resistance towards uncontrollable escalation. These two factors do not exist in a containment policy with Iran. We do not have a hotline. We do not have a diplomatic presence. We don't have any dialogue or diplomacy at all. We cannot sort out misunderstandings. In fact, Chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff just a couple of weeks ago again repeated and said that because of this lack of communication, he's very concerned that a very small incident in the Persian Gulf can spark a larger war because we don't communicate, which leads to miscalculation. The miscalculations leads to escalation.
So, Barbara, why do we not communicate in any real fashion with Iran?
Read my book. For 32 years, we have basically not communicated well with the Iranians. There have been efforts, but whenever the United States has been really ready, Iran has not, and vice versa. Those Iranians who've been brave enough to reach out to the United States have often found themselves purged from the Iranian system or discredited. Similarly, Americans who've reached out have found their overtures rebuffed and have been accused of being appeasers. It's just, it is such a love-hate relationship. There is so much pride, prestige involved in this, as well as real differences of opinion about how affairs should be conducted in that part of the world. There's the baggage that goes back from the U.S. Overthrowing an Iranian leader in 1953, having supported the Shah of Iran, who was extremely repressive. It's going to take years
and
to
go through.
And the
Iranian hostage crisis.
The hostage crisis, absolutely. And, of course, they just had hostages recently, these poor American hikers who were held. So it's going to take years to go through all these layers of distrust. At some point, the two sides are going to need to sit down and begin to do that. But it's just been very difficult.
Well, let's go to the phones, let our listeners join our conversation. You can give us a call 1-800-433-8850. Let's go to Julie first. She's calling us from Louisville. Hi, Julie.
Hi, good morning. While this conversation, which I've been listening to from the beginning, has evolved into a general discussion of U.S.-Iranian relations, I do want to bring us back just for a second, if I could, to from where it evolved, because I feel like, although I've been listening from the beginning, maybe I missed something. I believe that it was stated that there was no correlation between this still alleged plot between a few individuals, one based in Texas, no correlation or connection with the Iranian government. Yet this conversation is seemingly spun out of control and the Iranians has been a term that's been mentioned by your panel and you many times, and I just don't know why we're lumping all the Iranians when we're talking about an alleged plot, albeit a very serious one, but an alleged plot between a few individuals. And I wonder if you could just comment on why this generalization and this escalation has been made to even the term in the last, well, I was waiting to make my comment, the end of mankind. So I'll take my comment off the air.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Julie, thanks so much for your call. So is there evidence that of the Iranian government being involved, Michael?
Yes. I mean, first of all, I don't think it can be disputed that the Quds force was involved in this. And the question really is, was this a rogue operation with regard to the Quds force, or is it really representative of high Iranian policy to have committed this act? And what you're beginning to see from the wire service stories is when the Quds forces do something, it is cleared usually by the highest levels, the supreme leader in Iran. These things are discussed. So, again, I think we've all said that we need to see more evidence about this, but there is beginning to be laid out a theory. After all, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, the Saudis, of course, Kuwait, and other Middle Eastern countries were very quick to come to the table and say this is emanates from high levels in Iran. The Saudis publicly have been very careful not to allege Iranian involvement. But, for example, the ambassador, this ambassador who just left in 2007, said in London clearly this is an Iranian plot. So I don't think it's something that needs to be proved. And but it's still something that is worthy of discussion about. It certainly goes up into the Iranian system, how high up it goes, given the way the Iranian government has operated and the fact that they were operating on new territory here, not in the Middle East, but in North America. We have to take this seriously.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850. Trina.
I think the caller's question is actually very good, and I'm happy to see it, particularly after the Iraq debacle, that we are more cautious this time around about all of these different things and we don't rush to conclusion. I'm not so sure what the value of what the Bahraini government has said about this. I certainly hope that we're not basing our evidence on any intelligence or opinions coming from the Kingdom of Bahrain, mindful of the fact that they are in a very intense rivalry and conflict with the government of Iran, both of which, incidentally, recently have been tremendously brutal in clamping down against protesters in their own countries. But again, it goes back to the fact that the administration needs to come out and quickly put some of these questions to rest, show more evidence, because the country is not in the mood of another escalation. It's not in the mood of another war. And if there is evidence, there's really nothing to lose in presenting it.
Barbara, could this incident tell us something about what's happening inside the Iranian government? And that's been a hard place for us to get a confident sense of what's going on. Could it reflect disarray or divisions there?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. One possibility is that this was the harebrained scheme of the used car dealer in Texas, and that he presented it to his cousin, who then presented it to a general in the Quds force, and they talked about it and said, what the hell, we'll put a little money down and see whether something happens, you know. That also strikes me as rather out of character for the Quds Force, which has been a very disciplined elite unit. But Iran is in disarray. And if this is indeed a true set of allegations, it could suggest that the disarray has gone farther than we even thought, that the regime is really turning in on itself, that it no longer has the kinds of checks and balances against this kind of activity that it might have had in the past. What we've seen since the 2009 elections, which the Iranian government used to basically sideline the reform movement in the country, a large constituency, possibly even a majority, but certainly a large constituency. Now we see that in the remaining conservative ranks, they've turned against each other. So you have the president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and people around him against Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, and people around him. You have fights within fights, people accusing each other of corruption, of stealing money from banks. So within that context, you know, I suppose it's possible that there are factions within the Revolutionary Guard Corps that decided to mount an operation like this, perhaps to discredit other elements of the Iranian government. It's clear that the Iranian system is under great stress now.
Trita.
I agree with Barbara that the system in Iran is under tremendous amount of stress. I think the Iranian government has lost much of its momentum as a result of the Arab Springs. I still cannot fully compute why that would lead to them hiring or contacting whatever it is that they are alleged to have done. A former car salesman with a history of crime, with a history of not being able to keep a job, with a history of having actually getting divorced because his wife complained that he's too scatterbrained and disorganized. It just
doesn't sound... Yeah, he kept losing his car keys.
It's a little bit odd, to say the least.
He didn't seem like an ideal plotter from their point of view.
Yeah, the only thing I would say is when you're looking back at what the United States is trying to do now, it may be this very division within the government that the United States is trying to take advantage of. I mean, who would have thought before the Arab Spring that Mubarak and Omar Gaddafi would have been subject to overthrow? They may have intelligence that by rallying the world against the government, that will spring internal divisions and be helpful in diplomacy.
But if they believe this is true, how could they not take action? I mean, it's not exactly a choice. If you believe their case, how could they not make arrests
because the United States, I mean, it's true, as was said earlier, this is a slippery slope that has to be watched. But we cannot do another war. We have to be clever in our diplomacy. Mm-hmm. We can't open another front in the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. knew of this alleged plot from the very beginning, so we don't know how it was being manipulated.
We're going to take another very short break, and then we'll come back and we'll take your calls, 1-800-433-8850. We'll read some of your emails. You can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Vital Projects Fund, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now presenting a retrospective of Willem de Kooning, more at MoMA.org. From John and Catherine Debs, committed to advancing public understanding of America's energy needs and options. And by the Overbrook Foundation, supporting CatalogChoice.org, a nonprofit service that allows customers to decide which catalogs to receive in the mail. This is NPR.
Noise is the second biggest environmental factor affecting our health, but some sounds can improve our lives. How what you hear can make us more relaxed, productive, even smarter. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. With me in the studio, Barbara Slavin of the Atlantic Council, Michael Greenberger of the University of Maryland, and Trita Parsi. He has a new book coming out called A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Let's go to the phones and let some of our listeners ask questions, join the conversation. We'll go first to Mark, who's calling us from Boynton Beach, Florida. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Hey, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
It just seems very weird to me how things are playing out here. For Iran, under the circumstances of the situation in the region, all the problems that are happening over there, that they would try to pull this on U.S. soil where they could do it anywhere else, a country with a lot less security, less risk. I think that the credibility of the United States government is down to the lowest that it's ever been. I mean, you could go back in history and take a look at the things that we've done. I mean, we toppled their regime how many times? Two or three? And just look into Fast and Furious, all the problems that the corruption that seems to be happening with the Mexican drug cartel. So now Iran is using a drug cartel member to pull this. I mean, it's just unbelievable. I mean, look into the Northwoods project or Building 7 or the underwear bombing incident. This guy that almost got killed or was in the plane, Kurt Haskell, the underwear bomber, wanted to use him as a witness because he saw government agents put him on the plane. And now the government happened to not want to do that. Now the guy is guilty, and he's probably got some fixed deal with the government. It's just the U.S. government. Look at the Gulf of Tonkin.
All right. Yeah, Mark, going back a long way there. Certainly true. You certainly sound skeptical. We've got some other callers who are also expressing some skepticism. Barbara.
Yeah, well, the caller points out at the beginning of his comments that this is not the Iranian MO. How does Iran commit what we call acts of terrorism? It uses trusted agents, primarily Arabs, members of Hezbollah, the Lebanese militia that Iran helped found in the 1980s. It uses Muslims. It doesn't use Christians. Several of the terrorism experts I spoke with yesterday pointed out that Iran does not use Christians. They use Muslims and, if possible, Shia Muslims and, if possible, Arab Shia Muslims. If they wanted to kill Saudis, they could have done it in the region much more easily than in the United States with all the security that we have. And certainly using a Mexican drug cartel would be absolutely out of character.
I would just say that that assumes that Iran wanted to take credit for this when it was done. By going out of their I don't disagree with what Barbara says. I want to say that to be clear. And I don't disagree we need more facts. But I do think there's an argument on the other side. The reports are they did not want to take credit for this. They wanted to sow confusion and chaos within the United States. If they did it somewhere else, the United States is the big target. It's the big banana here. This is where you get the most bang for your buck. So, and also, all of their former clever terrorist attacks that follow the MO that Barbara talks about would never been done in North America. And a lot of people are saying their sophistication about how to get things done here is not what it is to get things done in Lebanon. So I think we have to be open-minded here. We do have to get more evidence, but I wouldn't shut the door on this being a problem.
We're deep, deep into speculation and hypotheticals on this one, clearly. But I would say one thing. The Iranian government has never tried to take credit for any of its terrorist acts.
That's true.
Ever. They're constantly out there denying any involvement, portraying themselves, and sometimes correctly, that they are also victims of terrorism. So the idea that they didn't want credit for it, again, I don't think adds, you know, added credibility to this. What we need is evidence. We need to have a different conversation from what we're having right now. I don't think this is to the benefit of the administration.
And of course, the administration is sending the FBI director up to the Hill today to offer more evidence, briefing international partners. So I think there is an effort to get more evidence out there in the face of the kind of skepticism that we've heard from Mark and others. Michael, I'd like to ask you a question as someone who's worked in the previous administration. Should Americans say, I feel very frightened by this because there is this plot to blow up a restaurant. I could have been eating in that restaurant on that day, or someone from my family. Or should they feel that there are people who are plotting this, but look, we caught them?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I don't know if I have a precise answer. The Obama, if you leave aside diplomacy in Iran, in terms of counterterror, the biggest argument the Republicans had against Obama was that he would not deal with this effectively. Well, he's gotten bin Laden, which was a courageous decision. He got Alaki through the drone missiles. They have had a lot of successes here. Now, you can say this is luck. The luck here was that this guy ended up talking to a DEA informant. He could have been talking to somebody else. But as everybody says, luck is a result of a lot of hard work. And I think we cannot ever say that we are not going to have an explosion in a restaurant in any big city in the United States. But I think the administration deserves credit for really turning around our counterterrorism policy and making it seem to the world something effective rather than laughable.
Let's go back to the phones. We'll talk to David. He's been holding on from Chesapeake, Virginia. David, thanks for holding on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I keep up with a lot of these events, and I've also worked in and around counterterrorism as well. But, you know, one thing I see with this is, you know, I do agree that, you know, the Obama administration has really stepped up a little bit on the whole counterterrorism. But I think it's been more luck than, you know, which does come from hard work and has been just due to the process, because there are a lot of things that break down. But I guess, you know, this just really still shows how vulnerable our U.S. system is when it comes to national security. You know, since 9/11, you would think that we would have a little bit better, you know, eyes dotted and T's crossed, but still there's still a lot of holes in it. And you know, I think too much emphasis is being put on the Iran issue versus really looking within the U.S. borders and the banks and everything else to wonder, you know, how did this get this far anyway? You know?
All right, David, thanks so much for your call. Barbara.
Yeah, you know, even if the person in Mexico hadn't been a DEA informant, this plot most likely would have been uncovered by the bank transfers. As we pointed out, $50,000 a pop, $49,000 plus a pop twice in August. That would have been detected because of the extraordinary measures that have been put in place since 9/11 to monitor large transfers of money. So, you know, I think actually the system worked quite well.
Trita?
Just to give an example of that, but also to kind of point out that I think that many of these financial sanctions are hitting the wrong people. If an Iranian-American today goes to visit his grandmother in Iran, while being in Iran, tries to check to see that his bills in the U.S. are being paid, and he logs on to his bank account from Bank of America or anything else, his bank account gets frozen because he just checked it from an IP that came from Iran. If he goes and tries to check his PayPal, it gets blocked and he gets frozen. He can't even access his money. So for the IRGC, if this plot is true, to be able to transfer $50,000 twice tells us something about who the sanctions are hitting and who it's not hitting.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I've been an expert witness in the attempt to prevent money laundering by banks. And in far too many cases, that $10,000 limit is totally ignored, is not surveilled. Now, I'm not saying in the overwhelming majority it is, but it doesn't surprise me that that $50,000 could have gotten through, I mean, depending on what bank was used. The anti-money laundering things, especially in the pre-2008 Wild West atmosphere of banks was not guarded as well as it could be.
But from Iran?
From Iran, from anybody. There can be people that they don't even bother to ask, are you from Iran, who are getting money through these banks. I was an expert witness in a case like that, thinking that these, after seeing the way banks handled their reckless investments, to think that there's counter-surveillance policy is well-crafted. You've got to think twice about that.
We have an email. Someone writes, over the past months, there have been assassinations of Iranian nuclear scientists in Iran. Why have these not generated more comments in the press and condemnations by the United States? These were probably carried out by the United States or Israel, but there was no outcry by the West. What's the situation there?
Actually, the United States did condemn these assassinations. Now, the Iranian government nevertheless continues to make the accusation that these scientists, over the course of 2 years, several of them have been assassinated or killed, were at the hands of either the United States or Israel. And in the conversation of trying to see, is there any motive, is there any reason for this escalation, one could perhaps point to these things and say, well, you know, we are technically at some form of a cold war with Iran. There are things going on. We've not taken credit for the Stuxnet virus that hit their nuclear program, but there's some hints here and there that indicates that the U.S. or Israel or both were involved in it. That's what we can't forget. A containment policy entails these kind of things. And it's very, very difficult to make sure that it doesn't escalate into a real war. In the past, again, as I mentioned earlier on, we were perhaps a bit lucky, but we also had factors that helped us. We had dialogue and we had an awareness of what conflict would be. We don't have that with Iran.
How many Iranian nuclear scientists have been assassinated in the last couple of years?
Four, I believe.
Four of them. And of course, this would seem to be an effort to undermine their nuclear program.
There's been attempts as well that have not been successful, uh-huh. but I think it may be up to four who have been killed.
Four been killed, yeah.
Yeah. And why has the you say the United States has condemned this? Why not more of a reaction in the West? Barbara, what
That's
do you think?
A very good question, isn't it? Because, you know, obviously there Iran has been sanctioned now six times by the UN Security Council for its nuclear program. And it has not stopped enriching uranium. And perhaps there's a little bit of a double standard here, that it's okay to resort to these kinds of methods to give Iran the hint that perhaps it should suspend its uranium enrichment. Of course, all it does is make Iran more defiant. And, you know, the knowledge of how to pursue this program is not limited. I'm sure there are plenty of replacements for those who've been killed.
Let's go to Houston, Texas, and talk to Jeff. Jeff, you're on the air.
Thank you. I just kind of had a quick question. You know, it's already been stated that the alleged plotter didn't have the knowledge, ability, or even the organized skills to carry anything out. What's the possibility that he's just a scapegoat? Or that, you know, while we're trying to track all these leads on him, something else isn't going behind that's more serious?
All right, Jeff, thanks very much. We did see some profiles this morning, and I saw one in the New York Times, another in the Washington Post, profiles of this guy, and it did sound like he was a little scatterbrained.
You know, agent provocateur, just a hapless guy trying to make a buck. You know, it sounds as though basically his life in the States was kind of a washout, and he'd gone back to Iran to make some money. Beyond that, we really don't know.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Frida.
Several people I've spoken to who have good access and knowledge about this have also indicated that perhaps this was a lone actor, perhaps there is some basis for this, but there's also a suspicion that perhaps the administration is perhaps blowing a little bit out of proportion for their political reasons, for the policy direction that they would like to take things. To go to the Security Council and make the case for another round of sanctions was not going to go anywhere. The Russians and Chinese had already put a stop to that. This, perhaps the calculation is, can change that.
You know, I was interested in the timing in that this could have, the United States could have released this at any time. We've known about this for some time. Do you think they waited until the Iranian hikers were released before making this case? The American hikers released from Iran, yes.
You know, it's possible, although the guy wasn't arrested until September 28th when he was bounced back from Mexico City, and the hikers had already been freed by then. If memory serves, they were freed a few days before that. So what explains the delay since the 28th, that I'm not sure. Maybe it just takes time to sort of write all this up, and maybe Michael would know better.
Well, I don't know better, but I'm inferring that I am very suspicious that they did wait for that to resolve itself, because they had this under control. It was not going to escalate in anything. They had this guy, I think he was arrested on the 26th, and then he could, you know, it could have happened. The one other thing I want to say is, making fun of the agent provocateur here, let's remember that the 20th hijacker, who was prevented from getting on the plane, went to a flight school to learn how to fly straight, but not how to take off or not how to land. And the flight instructor called the FBI. One of the great criticisms was that the FBI didn't follow that lead. But, you know, you can look back at this and say this was a joke, but the drug cartels in Mexico are a serious national security problem. They were trying to do something on North American soil. And I would say, they may have tried to disavow some terrorist attacks, but this one, I believe, an argument can be made, they didn't want to be anywhere near this.
Michael, has a Mexican drug cartel assassinated anybody in the U.S. who was not connected to the drug trade?
I don't know, but these guys are not exactly going to Sunday school on Sunday mornings.
But there's one thing to be said about this. I think it is extremely plausible that in a large plot, one or two people out of 30 or 40 could be buffoons. But if you have a plot in which essentially everyone is a buffoon, you know, some questions has to be asked about that.
Well,
you know,
I would just say certainly the Quds who are giving directions to this guy, one of them is well known in the Middle East as being a provocateur of terrorism. So they weren't all buffoons. Lee Harvey Oswald, don't forget, was not exactly the great. Now, that's all a conspiracy theory and everything else. Mm-hmm. But there's a cutout element to this, where Iran wanted to sow chaos, blame al-Qaeda, and get out of this thing. And this guy could have been the perfect foil.
Barbara.
No comment. No, really. I mean, this, we're all in the realm of speculation here. As I said, there are just so many questions about how this guy was able to operate while the U.S. government knew exactly what he was doing. We should remember also that the DEA informant was the one who suggested using plastic explosives to blow up a restaurant. So, you know, some of this was entrapment as well.
Well, we're going to hear more about this whole incident, I'm sure, in the weeks and months to follow. I want to thank our panel for being with us this hour. Trita Parsi, Barbara Slavin, and Michael Greenberger, thank you for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we are on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.